Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Good morning. Welcome to this edition of Atlanta Business Radio, powered by Business Radio X. I'm your host, Alex Gossett Shiflett, and we have three very special guests in our studio today. But before we get started, make sure you are connected with us on social media, Twitter at Business Radio X. Also, today's show, Atlanta Business Radio, you can follow us at Atlanta Biz Radio, and you can connect with me personally on Twitter at Alex G. Shiflett. Love to hear from you, and you can check out our pictures of our guest in the studio. All right. Well, our first guest today is Sean Henry. Sean is the founder and CEO of Stored. He has an extensive background in entrepreneurship and a passion to innovate static industries. At age 11, Sean launched his first successful tech business, an iPhone repair company, in a personal effort to afford his own phone. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
And our other guest today is Tony. And Tony, say your last name for me.
Sakic.
Yes. Okay. That's great. Tony is the director of marketing for
Augur.
Tony's been responsible for many successful campaigns in the tech space, including creating, managing, and executing the successful crowdfunding for
Augur, yes.
Raising $5.3 million and becoming one of the 25 most successful crowdfunding companies in history. Wow, welcome to the show,
Thank
Tony.
Thank you also very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to start with you, Sean. The first question I have to ask, it's got to be, you became an entrepreneur at the age of 11.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Well, I like to say that was my sort of first brush with entrepreneurship. So I've always been a very problem solver thinker. So whenever I had a problem, especially growing up, or wanted to essentially buy something, in that case, I would work my way around trying to figure out how to create a business out of it so that I could get it. So in that case, I really wanted an iPhone and I was 11. So of course, my parents weren't going to buy me a phone. So I basically began repairing and then purchasing and repairing and reselling phones and computers until I could afford my own phones and laptops. That sort of went with me throughout the genesis of my different businesses. After that, in high school, actually, I ran a luxury car brokerage service and repair. So in an effort to, in that case, afford a nicer car, I began buying and selling Ferraris and Porsches for anyone I could find and anyone I could help.
Wow. Wow. Well, tell us a little bit about your education.
Yeah. So I went to, for high school, I went to the Galloway School. It's very close by in Atlanta. And then I'm actually currently still a student at Georgia Tech here in Atlanta.
Okay. And when will you be graduating?
Quite a long time. May of 2019.
Okay. But you've done a lot and you haven't even graduated yet. Tell us about how you got the idea for Stored.
Yeah, so Stored sort of came out of, I was looking at this whole new idea of the sharing economy. And I was actually reading an article that was very interesting about how, everyone's heard it by now, in 2016, Uber's the largest taxi service, doesn't own any cars. Airbnb is the largest accommodation service, doesn't own any real estate. And I kept looking at this idea. And in fact, my family was going to move my sister into college at New York, where they were going to have to pay somewhere around $150 a day for parking alone. So I began looking at the sharing economy in the sense of parking and sort of found that there was competition already, but kept looking at how can you take the idea of using someone's garage or driveway and sort of make that a higher recurring payment, which is sort of where Stored was born. So the first genesis of Stored was that we were a marketplace for self-storage. So if you had an empty garage, basement, attic, or something like that, you could actually rent it out to your neighbors or people who needed storage space. Based on the market and sort of the customer feedback we got, we have developed to the on-demand side of things. So now what we provide is on-demand storage and moving solutions, sort of taking the hassle out of the storage industry.
Okay. So first of all, where are you located?
We're in Atlanta, so there's actually a co-working space we work out of called Switch Yards down on Ted Turner Drive.
Okay. I'm trying to get it straight, what exactly, what it is that you do, and you provide storage space.
Yeah, so as opposed to a storage facility, which is sort of a semi-archaic process where you have to organize a truck, movers, and drop off your stuff at your storage unit, basically, what we provide is you book online with us, we send someone out, we pick up your belongings, we take a photo inventory of them as we pick them up, and then warehouse them. So as opposed to going to your storage unit and picking something up, you would go online and log into your account and you would see your 20 different boxes, your sofa and your desk, and you can request any of those back whenever you want or everything back. So it takes the pain out of the storage industry.
So it's kind of like the Ritz of storage,
yeah,
right?
Because it's full service.
It's full service because you don't have to pack up everything. Someone will come and do that for you, take it. And then if you need something, you guys will go and deliver it.
Exactly. So part of the problem with storage, if anyone has ever rented storage, is that they all say, I don't even remember what I have in storage. So a lot of the times, the reason people leave things in storage for 10, 20 years is because they forget what's there and they just don't see any use for it anymore. So we take that pain point out of storage by providing you that inventory where you can easily access all of your belongings and get them back on demand. So rather than have to haul your way over to your storage unit once a month or once a week, you just log onto your account and say, oh, I need box number 0034 back, for example.
And how did you come up with this idea?
So this idea, based on the marketplace idea, we sort of said, as everyone's probably heard, there's if you want to beat an incumbent in an industry, you have to be 10 times better and cheaper. And so when we were doing the marketplace, we basically saw this is working really well for people who have some specific need for a garage or basement in their area, like they're a contractor or they have a boat or something of that sort. But the general pain point people have with storage is the moving aspect of it and the fact that they don't actually enjoy going to the storage facility. So this sort of takes all of that hassle out of it for them and is really a lot easier to convert people. And it's something that clicks with people immediately. So if you say, you can rent a basement from someone in your neighborhood, someone will sort of think, okay, that's interesting. But if you say, we provide storage where we pick it up, inventory for it for you, and return it for a similar price to self-storage, it's an immediate, why haven't I used that before?
And would you say that that's the most important aspect of the company, is that customer service?
Yeah, I think our sort of our North Star, what we try to strive for, is just betterment of the industry. So we could easily be a self-storage facility and have super low prices that we get everyone in our neighborhood. But what we're really interested in doing is finding those pain points with this industry and solving them for the customer.
And what is your overall goal for Stored? What do you want to see happen?
So my overall goal would eventually be a franchising model of sorts. So we actually are working on partnerships with the moving side of things, but we're currently trying to develop very good warehouse management system so that if we're taking in people's boxes and then people's couches as well, we have the burden of warehousing that and tracking all of it. So as soon as we nail that down in Atlanta of how we're offering that, it becomes a little bit easier to scale our warehouse operations, especially when we're working on partnerships with moving companies that can then provide the pickup for us and handle the logistics and understand our business.
Sean, tell our audience how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Sean Henry, ATL, that's S-E-A-N, or my email is sean@stored.co, S-T-O-R-D.co.
Okay, good. We're going to come back to you, but right now I want to turn to Tony. And Tony is the director of marketing for
Auger.
Okay. I looked this up, Tony, when I was preparing for this interview, and I still don't understand what Auger is. Can you explain it to our audience and just picture us as being the most just dumbest audience in the world? We're not, but try to explain it to us on a very basic level.
Sure. It is a complicated project, so it does take a minute regardless of how hard you try. Part of why I was there was to simplify this. The first thing that I like to explain is that it's built on blockchain technology similar to Bitcoin. Basically, instead of using it as a financial transaction, there's different blockchains that you can use as basically giant global computers, where every node is someone's running a certain piece of software at their home. That's the first thing to understand. So I like to explain that first and foremost, because that immediately throws people for a loop, because understanding Bitcoin and understanding how that technology works is very difficult, but it's really core to what we're doing, even though it's not exactly what we do. So I always like to start with that and then say Augur is a decentralized prediction market platform. The decentralized nature is what I mentioned when there's computers around the world that are running it instead of one central server. So what happens is anyone can create a market on any future event, and a good example is the presidential election. Will Hillary Clinton win the election? And you fund that market and say, I have $500 US that says she will, and then others can participate in that market. Now, what this does is it's not only a market, and you use cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or Ether at this point, but we're going to have a way where you will be able to use other currencies, fiat currencies, the US dollar, pound, euro, whichever you want to use. In the future, this is far away, though, because it's very early in the development of blockchain technology in general. And what we want is this, well, to be the first global prediction market, because there have been prediction markets in the past. Intrade, who we work with, one of their founders, was very successful, extremely successful in this space. There's been many other prediction markets, but they've been limited to regions, whereas this is the first global one because it uses cryptocurrency. So anyone in the world can use Bitcoin. The advantage of that is it technically would be the most powerful forecasting tool ever, because prediction markets are the most accurate way to predict anything. They're far more accurate at predicting who will win the presidential primary than a poll would be. A gentleman by the name of Nate Silver proposed that a global prediction market would be far more accurate than even his forecast. And he's very well known for having accurate forecasts on 538.com, which is a kind of a big news site for news statistical site for politics and sports. So it's really a new way of kind of getting all this information out there and having markets created and participated in to ask any question and say, okay, here's what the question is. Here's what the answers can be. Now, put your money where your mouth is and say, what's this answer going to be? So essentially, it's futures markets, but there's all kinds of other different aspects and little side roads that I can go on here, but I always like to try to keep it simple. And I don't think I did make it as simple as possible, but I always recommend to everyone saying, If you're coming at this from a very point A thing, disregard the decentralization blockchain part, even though it's central to what we're doing and what makes us different, and just view it as a prediction market part. And the prediction markets in the past have all been limited to one region. We're global.
Okay, let's go back.
Okay. That's okay.
What is fintech and blockchain?
Okay.
Explain those first. And we'll take it from there.
Sure, sure. I'll start with fintech. Fintech in general is just financial technologies, which range from anything from Venmo, which a lot of people use to send money between others, to PayPal, to, those are just two payment options, but there's a lot of others. There's remittances, there's Abra, which is another blockchain one, and anything under that umbrella. Now, when it goes to blockchain, that gets a lot more complicated. It essentially, what it is it's a decentralized ledger that records every single transaction that's occurred in history. And what happens is the computer that you're sitting in front of can be a node in the network. So instead of a server that's owned by Amazon or a server that's owned by Microsoft or a server that's owned by Google, the server essentially is computers around the world that are running it. It's a lot like BitTorrent. It's another decentralized technology. That would be the best similarity I can make, because not everyone is familiar with BitTorrent, but it's still very successful and it's been around for about 10 years. And it was really the first decentralized way to transfer files in a very, very actually efficient way.
Let's go to the startup of your company.
Mm-hmm.
You started out with 6 people.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, yes, I was one of the founding 6. I always say there's two lead developers are who I consider the founders, and I used air quotes there, even though I really didn't, but I did audio. And then I joined on shortly thereafter, and basically it was a good idea that we had, and we knew that, you know, it basically needed to exist. And there was this technology coming out called Ethereum, which was just launching, and we were one of the first high profile projects on it. And it's got it's received a lot of press lately. I just was on BBC.com, which is pretty cool.
Cool.
Yeah, this was about January of last year when I joined. Our crowd sale was in September. So it was just that build up to messaging, you know, getting everything down pat. And then from there, developing it, because there's many steps in that way. And this is kind of a new way to fund a new company. So
far you've managed to raise $5.3 million.
Yes. We had a crowd sale, and it was which for decentralized tokens, which I don't want to get too complicated on this because it's not central to using it. It's more central to the cryptocurrency space. But we raised $5.3 million. We're still in the top 25 crowdfunded projects of all time. And essentially what it did is it gave anyone who participated a vested interest in the system, as they are responsible for reporting on events. So the people that bought into the crowd sale will be the ones that say, did Hillary win? Yes or no? And they're the ones that will be responsible for saying, yes, she did win, or no, she didn't. So, and what happens is if they're truthful, they gain more tokens. And if they're dishonest, they lose tokens. And the tokens are a decentralized cryptocurrency, much like Bitcoin or Ether, which is the Ethereum token. The complicated topic, but basically a couple projects in the past few months have had some very successful campaigns. I've consulted with one named Digix that raised $5.5 million in 12 hours. We did not accept U.S. We did not accept any fiat currency during this crowd sale. We only accepted Bitcoin and Ether. We converted it to U.S. dollars. Not all of it, but some of it, because you want to hedge against volatility, because cryptocurrencies are extremely volatile. But in that way, it's really a brand new way of funding a company. And you know, we're actually a nonprofit. We're an open source project. Actually, we're not a traditional startup that would have VC funding. We're an open source project, so anyone can contribute and see all of our source code.
Okay, Tony, who is your target audience?
At different points in the project, different people. For the crowd sale, it was the crypto community. For the full launch, which we don't want to set a solid date for, but we're right now in beta and it's operational. But for the full launch, we're aiming toward people that are very familiar with cryptocurrencies in the beginning, and then slowly building to a more mainstream audience that would participate in regular traditional prediction markets. But there's other technologies that need to be developed before we can really target that audience. So we're kind of dependent on others' timelines, but the good thing is that the crowd sale was so successful that we have time to fund the company and make sure that development continues and these technologies are implemented.
Okay, Tony, let's pretend that I'm a customer, you're the salesperson. How do you get me to be active in your business?
The first thing I would say is the first customers that we would target, and I'm assuming you're one of the first, it would be people that are already familiar with cryptocurrency. So I would say, would you like to create a market on something that's going to happen in the future? Here are the advantages. Here are the disadvantages. I would say that, and I believe this is true in all aspects of sales. Just be honest and say, okay, there are disadvantages right now, and there are advantages. And when the project fully launches and we're going to have individuals that are creating markets and participating in markets, we want to make sure that they're completely aware of everything that's happening. So we want this to be a long-term thing. We don't necessarily, we're not looking for this quick growth. We would love it, but it's also, we want to make sure that the growth happens as the technology progresses. So we're trying to have a very fly by your seat timeline. So in answer to that question, and I kind of veered off topic there, is at this point, the customers that we're aiming for are just beta users. So it's people that don't have anything to lose. They don't have to spend any money. So at this point, it's really easy. It's just getting people that know about cryptocurrency and prediction markets to create a market and use the play money we have right now in there. In the future, it's going to be people that have cryptocurrency, because they're going to be the ones that create the market. So it's still our target audience for the short term.
Okay. And you have a history in music.
Yes.
Tell us how that has helped.
It helped a lot, actually. I worked for a record label that was associated with Eminem. I'm a native Detroiter.
So, oh, really?
Yes. I worked for Web Entertainment. So if you have any of his older CDs, I think even up to 2010, turn it over, there's a little Web logo. I worked out of his studio in Ferndale. And what it taught me, and it actually what kind of led me to this point here, is one, I've always been a tech geek, so that helped. And the second thing that really helped was, this was around 2003, 2004, and I remember making suggestions saying, hey, why don't we give this album, which wasn't Eminem, it was a related artist, I don't want to name, but a rap album, let's give it away for free on the internet. The looks I got at that were just like, what are you doing? These are old school music types. And to me, it was like, okay, well, the record's not selling. So if 100 people download it and one more person buys it, that's one more sale than we have now. That mindset didn't click. And then I kind of saw, okay, well, if you're not ready to evolve, you're going to die. And some of them did evolve, some of them didn't. The music industry took a big hit. But then I saw the same thing happening in finance with Bitcoin. And I said, okay, And banks are not, they're not the same as the music industry. Banks figured it out quick. And I've been actually consulting with banks too, as on the side while augers in development, because my role has been a little bit reduced, which is awesome. So I'm able to kind of talk to different people about it. But I'm still, you know, the director of marketing. I just don't have as much to do as I did when we were building the crowd sale, and I'm going to have to do in a few months when we're having our full launch. So it's pretty cool. But the music industry helped me a lot in that way, because it kind of showed me, if you don't adapt, you will die. And and that's not a good or bad thing. You can fight it all you want, and you can spend as much money if you want, but your money's better invested adapting rather than trying to fight it.
Exactly. We've heard that a lot in this room with discussions about that. And how can our audience get in touch with you, Tony?
Sure. To get in touch with, first, if you want to check out Augur, the beta is live at augur.net. You can get information about the project at augur.org, including the GitHub page if you want to review or contribute to the project, because it's open source. Myself personally, the best way to get a hold of me is Twitter, which is at Tony Swish. It's TonySwish. And Augur is at Augur Project. That's AUGUR Project. They're both, we try to maintain the Twitter the most. We're on all the other social outlets too, but there's always one that we prefer. We also have an Augur subreddit at rAugur. The community is really cool and growing. We got about, I think, 2,000-ish members now. It's real active. It's getting more and more active. So we encourage everyone to participate in that as well.
Okay, thank you. And we'll come back to you, Tony. But right now, I'd like to introduce our third guest. Her name is, pronounce it for me, Madupe Ozulo. And if you would put the mic from a little closer, there you go. Now, say your name one more time. Madupe Ozulo is a social entrepreneur and philanthropist. She is the chief executive officer of Body Enhancement Limited in Nigeria. Body Enhancement LTD pioneered cosmetic surgery in Nigeria in 2001 and aesthetic lasers in 2007. She is also the founder and president of Body Enhancement Annual Reconstructive Surgery, BEARS, B-E-A-R-S, Foundation from Cosmetic Surgery Procedures. Madupe now gives hope to the less privileged. Madupe is also a princess from the Benin kingdom. Oh, I said it right. Good. Okay, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. And if you would, audience, Madupe was running a little late, so she just come in, so I'm going to have to tell her to speak directly into the mic. There you go. Okay. Tell us about... I have to start with the fact that you're a princess first. We can't go on to any other questions until you tell us about being a princess.
Well, it's a title. That doesn't exactly indicate or dictate who I am as an individual. But I am from the royal family, the Benin Kingdom, which is in Edo State, Nigeria, not Republic of Benin, which is a neighboring country. So people tend to get that a little bit confused. But I am from the Benin Kingdom, from the royal family, Ozulua. And actually, my mother was also a princess from her tribe, also in Edo State, a place called Ososo. So it does come with its own responsibilities, but life does come with its own responsibilities also. So it's a title which I do appreciate, nevertheless.
Okay, and tell us about your background, your education.
I went to high school and... all of high school in Nigeria. Then my parents sent me to the U.S. So I went to college in San Diego and also in Los Angeles. I finally went back to Nigeria in 2001. I have a dual citizenship, so I'm both the U.S. and Nigerian citizen. And I, at that point, pioneered cosmetic surgery in West Africa. That was in 2001. So based on that, it's quite... challenging having to run a business and live in two different continents. So at some point I decided to move back home, which is Nigeria, and pretty much commute back and forth. I have different businesses in Nigeria, but pretty much globetrotting quite a bit.
And when you first came to the United States, tell us about your very first job.
Interesting. My parents were not very fond of that idea. They didn't support it. But I had a cousin, actually, who had visited, who used to come on holidays, and she worked at McDonald's. And I used to hear all these fascinating stories because, to me, I thought it was amazing. When we came on holidays, we were not allowed to work. So when I came to go to school here, I've always been independent, always wanted to prove myself because everyone in the family felt I was very happy-go-lucky. And I spoke to one of my uncles, and he helped me. I applied, and I got a job at McDonald's.
And Mickey D's.
And it was in the kitchen, which is very interesting because I had never cooked before in my life. And I remember there was a, and this was in Massachusetts, in Natick. There was this manager, one of the managers at that particular location. Every time I would pick up the trays when they put the buns in the little toasters, it wasn't hot, but I had never held anything that hot before, and I would keep dropping them. And then it got to a point where, like, look, she's costing us money. She's going to get fired. But I remember this particular manager pulled me to the side and he said, listen, if you want this job, you need to pull yourself together. And he saw something in me that I didn't even see at that time. He said, I know you can do it. And the fact that he gave me that pep talk made me pull my weight. And the next thing I knew, I was so good. I was running the kitchen. I was helping, you know, even when they had staff come in. And I actually used that as a, I tell my staff that story when I give them the opportunities to prove themselves whenever they're falling behind expectations. Because someone gave me the chance to pull, you know, prove myself. So I give people the opportunity. But when, of course, there's a point, then it's like, okay, that's it. So that was quite interesting. And it taught, there's a lot of work. Standing on my feet all day. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work. And it created a lot of, I learned a lot of discipline, and which has helped me in all the ventures in my life. And my parents really respected me for that.
Right. All started there at Mickey D's.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about your company, Body Enhancement.
Body Enhancement was the reason why I went back to Nigeria. We introduced cosmetic surgery. So what happens is I have plastic surgeons from the U.S. that come to Nigeria. And I'm the magnet that holds everything together. I consult with the clients. I don't have a medical background, but I'm so involved that pretty much I can tell you what needs to be done. So I consult with the clients. I have everything all set up. The surgeons come in. I make sure everything works. And I am in the operating room during procedures.
Really?
Oh, yes. And then when they leave, I work with local indigenous doctors to go over postoperative care. We also pioneered, introduced the first aesthetic laser to Nigeria, laser hair removals and things like that. It's been great because when you become synonymous with a service in a country, that has put us on the map through Body Enhancement. We have put Nigeria on the map of countries in the world that you can have cosmetic surgery, which is amazing. We've been featured on CNN, BBC, The Works. But that opened a better door, a greater door, in my opinion, in the sense that everyone, when they talk about plastic surgery in Nigeria, they refer to Body Enhancement or they mention my name. And of course, we also offer reconstructive surgeries, but of course, that's for people paying for those services. But the icing on the cake, in my, as far as I'm concerned, was that made me have access to underprivileged people that needed reconstructive surgery but couldn't pay for it because they also came to my office. And I'm always one-on-one with my clients most of the time when I'm around. And at that point, I realized that there were so many people that needed help, but nobody was helping them. So that led to the creation of the nonprofit. And a lot of our surgeons from the U.S. and other parts of the world volunteer, and we do free reconstructive surgeries for them at no charge whatsoever, amongst other services also.
Wow. And so how did you get to Atlanta?
I have friends here and family.
Okay.
And we had reached out to the mayor's office, and there's a lady, Claire Angel. She's the director of international affairs. She's been absolutely amazing. The goodwill, the positive support we've received from the city has been very encouraging. That's why we're planning on being locals here, having an office here as a presence for the U.S., because we are registered as a nonprofit here. In the past, it was Beers Foundation, but people got confused because the word insurer, is it an animal?
Right.
Is this inclined?
Bears, yes.
But so we recently had it changed to Empower 54, which 54 represented the 54 countries in Africa, because we do activities in other parts of Africa, not just Nigeria. So we're having because of, like I said, the great, amazing response we've received here, we're planning on having some activities like one coming up on the 30th, which is a charity, an art auction to raise funds for some of the activities we're doing in Northeast Nigeria.
Is this the art gala that you're speaking of? Tell our audience about that.
Of course, there are so many causes, so many needs all over the world. One has to be quite creative when you're trying to get raise funds. We decided to use this as a medium. On the 30th at the Bisharat Gallery, we're auctioning stunning Nigerian art pieces, paintings and sculptures. Since last year, January, we have been rebuilding schools destroyed by Boko Haram. I'm sure you're familiar with Boko Haram, the terrorist group in West Africa. Yes. We decided to get involved in rehabilitating the survivors of that of those attacks because we've observed that a lot of nonprofit and also the Nigerian government, what they were doing was more of relief, you know, foods, mattresses, which is great. That's the camps, the survivors, but that's not helping them reintegrate into society and rebuild their lives in any way. So we decided to come and get involved from a different perspective. So we started going to different camps, getting a lot of data as to the women, what skills they had prior to being displaced. And based on that, those that are tailors, those that are farmers, you know, we give them we give them sewing machines, farmers, seedlings, fertilizers and things like that. So there's that trading even in the camps. And they save money and move themselves and their families into the host communities. In the camps, we set up schools for the children, give them books, writing materials, uniforms, hire teachers to teach them. And in addition, the host, the communities that were destroyed by Boko Haram are not empty. There are people living in there, millions of people. And I know because I'm always in those areas. So we decided we need to get those children engaged because if they are not, the recruiters that the terrorist group has, they're the ones that will go to them and give them a reason to have a cause to live. So we've started rebuilding schools so these children can go back. So the event on the 30th is raising funds through selling art to support that cause because you can imagine it's quite capital intensive.
And tell our audience how they can be a part of the art gala.
There is on our website, www.empower54.org. There's a lot of details about that. And then those that are familiar with the Bisharat Gallery, they are on Peter Street. They also have some information on their website. We are selling tickets because we're trying to raise money. It's $50 per ticket. There's going to be food, drinks. You have the auction. And as a registered nonprofit here, donations are, of course, tax deductible because we have a 501c3. And then, of course, this event is the way I like to say it's a coming out party because there are more issues on ground because we want people to know what we've been doing this since 2003. So the organization has been in existence for 13 plus years. And we have His Emeritus Archbishop Desmond Tutu as our patron. So we have some good people with us because we're doing good things and we're a credible organization. So people can support in different ways. We always get donations of clothing, of toys. And also we're looking for corporate and individual support in different ways. There are organizations and individuals looking for how to channel programs or sponsor programs in different parts of Africa, but have no idea who to partner with. And we're definitely presenting ourselves as a medium because we do have a wide reach across the continent. So they can go to the website, like you said.
Okay. And tell us about your celebrity co-host.
Which of them?
Kat Graham.
Kat Graham has been fantastic. She was introduced to us by the mayor's office and she did some background check on us and was very impressed about what we're doing decided to jump on board with her very busy schedule. And of course, you know, she is a dedicated philanthropist. She's very much involved in different programs with the UN and different organizations. So we're very happy she agreed to partner with us on this. And she did a video, which we have on our YouTube channel and also on the website, supporting the cause. And we also have a video from our patron, His Emeritus, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, also about the cause. So she's amazing. And she's going to be there at the event on the 30th.
And I see that you've received a lot of support from the city of Atlanta. Is there anyone in particular you would like to thank?
There are very many. okay, hold on.
No problem.
Well, we have, of course, the city of Atlanta. We have his Ambassador Andrew Young Foundation. We have also the Nigerian consulate. It's, of course, proper protocol. We can't come to Atlanta and not inform them officially. So the Nigerian government is definitely with us on this. We have Africa Atlanta. We have, of course, the Bisharat Gallery. Coca-Cola is supporting us with some products. Global. A lot of different organizations and individuals are throwing their weight behind this. And we can't thank everyone enough.
Okay.
And of course, thank you for the audience, Jim.
And yes. And tell our audience one more time, if they would like to be a part of this event, how can they get tickets?
They can go. We do have an Eventbrite page. And so they can search Empower 54, E-M-P-O-W-E-R, the numbers 54. Or they can go to our website, www.empower54.org. We have a lot of links on there to the direct pages to get the tickets.
Okay. We're going to try something new on the show today. We've never done this. But I'm going to open up the floor and see if you guys have any questions. Mudape or Tony or Sean, if you have questions for each other, feel free to just jump in and ask.
Yeah, I'd love to start a little bit for Augur. I just have a question. I know you hear a lot about financial institutions of sorts trying to start up, facing a lot of legalities and a lot of things blocking their way. I just want to hear a little bit about how you guys have confronted that and pushed forward so well regardless.
Good question. One that I have to give the typical marketing answer to, but I'm going to give you, I'll go a little deeper. The typical marketing answer is I'm not an attorney, so I can't go into that detail level of detail because it's such a weird area. And it is, and but I will say this, it's new. It's so new that the regulatory aspect isn't there as far as the crypto space. So, you know, it's like the same advantage, same thing with technology. We want to make sure that we're the ones that do this project. We want to make sure that this gets done and we want to make sure that it happens. We're going to make sure everything that we do is legal. We have a great legal team with Pillsbury who know more about the crypto space than any other legal team in the world. So we're making sure that everything we do consults with them and making sure those things go forward. But yes, it's very difficult, and especially for open source projects, because there's so many different aspects to them. Whereas most open source projects just start out as a guy coding and creating a GitHub page and someone else contributes to it voluntarily. For us, it's a little different because we have a core team. We have volunteers, but we also have programmers that are under the foundation. So it is a little different than a lot of other open source projects, but you know, Augur's built on the open source ideology. So that ideology matters a lot in our decision-making for things like that. And you know, open source software is really the backbone of the internet. So we want to make sure that that continues to grow and that there's new ways to use it and new projects. And if Augur can be used as an example of something, a new way to create something that's open source, we're definitely into that. So I do apologize for not being able to go in extreme depth on that. It's just the legality issue is one that's a can of worms that if I opened it could go on forever. And it's something where there's probably tons of intricacies that I'll miss.
Yeah, no, I just think it's impressive you guys have been able to push forward. So my second question would be, a lot of times you guys probably know because you're so successful at crowdsourcing funding, you sort of have to have a specific purpose as to why you chose that route to be successful. You have to be really keen on your marketing. So I was interested to hear sort of why did you choose crowdsourcing, and could you explain the rewards you gave for that to the people who invested?
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say, and I'll answer your second question first, is the reward is the token, because the token is a cryptocurrency. So the token gains value, it loses value. So that's the reward in and of itself. That's why I use the term crowd sale, because we're not the first, but we were one of the most successful. And it happened during a very bearish market. If it happened right now, we probably would have raised 10 or 15 million. And I don't say that facetiously. So that's the first thing. The second thing is why we went that route. One is because we were in a space where we could. Two, we needed a way to distribute the tokens because that's how the people will report on events. All right. If you're reporting on an event, those are the people that really make the system work. And they need an incentive to report on the event. And we need a way that they can immediately report on events as soon as the project launches. So this is a way to distribute those tokens and ensure that they participate. The simple answer is that we were really able to just hone our message to the crypto space, right? There's all these folks that got into Bitcoin. Now, there's the reason I'm in Atlanta is because a company named BitPay, they hired me and moved me here. And they're a great company. And we worked with Microsoft, Warner Brothers, Newegg, and we helped them accept Bitcoin. The thing is, there's still a lot of people that really got Bitcoin rich. And even though it's not trading for what it once was, it's still, they made millions of dollars and they want to invest in other projects. So we go, okay, if they want to invest in other projects, let's give them one to invest in. Augur is one of those projects. So that was another thing. And I'll say one other quick thing about the marketing that I wanted to mention. When you mentioned the video with Desmond Tutu, very good, I wouldn't say tactic, but very good use of, you know, someone who is supporting of your cause. And what we did was we created a video called How Augur Works. And I reached out to a good friend, Shooter Jennings, the son of Waylon Jennings. He's a great friend and he supports the crypto space, but to a ridiculous degree. And he was able to actually go into his XM radio studio or Sirius and do the voiceover. And he didn't charge me anything, but you know, he's just a great guy. And that video, and not only that, that video explained our, and I would encourage anyone listening earlier when you asked, you know, what's your project all about? Just Google How Augur Works. We've got over 200,000 hits right now on it. It's the most successful prediction market video in YouTube history by about 180,000 video views. So this isn't a topic or a subject that tons of people are interested in, but enough that the people that are players have a great financial stake in it. So yeah, that was a huge point in kind of how it worked and really honing our messaging down to that audience. So that was another reason that we went that route, is because we knew that we could kind of make our message concise enough to where people that have cryptocurrency will want to invest.
Okay. And then finally, the question, AUGUR, where did Augur come from?
Okay. When people hear Augur, they think of drill, but it's AUGUR, which is funny because for promotional tchotchkes, we have actual corkscrews with Augur on them. But AUGUR is actually a term for like an oracle or someone that can predict the future. Since we're a prediction market, basically that's essentially what we did is, okay, we wanted to be that. We wanted to be, you know, seen as someone where you can get an answer to a question. And one of the goals we have is the ability in the future, instead of saying you Google it, you Augur it. You can get the most accurate results on the probability of a future event. Like, will it rain on Tuesday? If there's a market about it, you could Augur it. That's like, someone actually came up with that, not us, one of the supporters. And I saw it and I was like, I'm stealing that. I'm like, that's so cool to say. If we ever get to that point, mission accomplished, right?
Okay. Tony, do you have a question?
I have tons. First of all, how is your project, or for Stored, first, how is your project spelled?
STORD, Stored.
I'll say, well, that's funny. And there's another project in the crypto space. It's called Storge, STORJ. Essentially the same thing you have, except for instead of, when I heard about it, I thought it was funny. And they're actually also based in Atlanta. So instead of leasing out storage space in their house, they lease out storage space on their hard drives and basically creating a giant cloud network for storage, which is really funny. I just thought that was very interesting that here's these two companies that both end in, you know, basically the same exact thing. I think it's a great idea. What I wonder though is what have your challenges been? Has it been scaling? Has it been anything else?
Yeah. So a challenge we initially faced when we did the marketplace side of things, which is what you just mentioned, was the sort of chicken egg fallacy of a marketplace. So especially if you're talking about almost a local service, which is you need real estate in really specific markets, then you need to really nail down where you're targeting. So in that case as well, if one of the pain points I mentioned of self-storage in general is the convenience factor, that people don't want to move their things and haul them, you really have to nail down where those customers are. So that was one of our first problems with the marketplace, which is why we've now switched to the on-demand side of things. And the biggest problem I can say we're going to face with the on-demand side of things, which we're, like I said, working on strategic partnerships to sort of solve, and if those go through very soon, then they will be solved, is just the logistics portion of things is a massive headache. So if you talk about warehousing items and tracking them, you can really decrease the cost of storage in general for the end consumer, because you're not talking about a multi-million dollar building on Roswell Road. You're talking about a warehouse where the space is very flexible, and you also have vertical space as well. But the problem is the logistics aspect of things. So that there you have to have trucks, you have to have movers, you have to have insurance, licensing, bonding. So if we want to do that ourselves, that becomes more of a 3 or 5 year project, not a scalable tech forward startup. But if we pair with a company that is already great at doing that aspect of things, then we really have the chance to scale. And we've really lucked into the fact that we've found a great partnership for us, we think. I mean, the company we're working with right now is extremely tech forward and wanting to adopt some of our practices. I mean, they even implement body cameras on all their movers so that they can track exactly what happened and make sure nothing is going wrong in your home. So a partnership like that will solve all of our early stage problems, we believe. But then after we get that headache out of the way, it's just how do we best implement warehouse tracking to reduce time between you saying, I want one of my bins or one of my couches back, and the time you actually get it back? And how do we make it extremely cost effective for us?
Sounds good.
And did you have a question for Mudape?
I do actually, because since we're both technically working on that as nonprofits, because Augur is under the nonprofit, the Forecast Foundation, again, augur.org. And what have been some of the challenges with that? Has it been something where this is the first nonprofit I've been a part of, but we're a very unique and different nonprofit. We're nonprofit because it's an open source project. So it's not exactly trying to raise funds for something I would say is directly that helps people as directly as you're doing. So I would imagine that it's very, there could be different challenges that we have. I would almost say drastically different challenges. So I'd like to hear a little bit about what those have been and what's been easier because of it maybe.
Definitely, there are many challenges, especially this is our first time making an attempt to raise funds in the U.S. So it's we're learning as we go every day, because especially as using the medium as an art auction, that also has its own challenges trying to break into reach the right audience, not just for example, this event, our target audience is not just art lovers, but people that want to support a cause. And also we want corporate bodies and other organizations to support and know about what we're doing, to look at the different activities that we do. So that's quite tricky, trying to reach the right people within a short period of time and then link up with them. In Nigeria, raising funds, that's also quite challenging because we are very, everything is politically linked. Mm-hmm. and unfortunately, a lot of people are not very into giving unless they have something to receive. If you're a politician, and so if I were, example, the wife of a governor or something like that, and I'm having a fundraiser to save cats, everybody will be there because they have interests, their business interests, which is fine. I understand all that. But at the same time, unfortunately, the economy is not exactly at its best right now. As you know, we do rely on oil explorations and the production for our own GDP. So that the price of oil barrel is going very low all over the world. So there's not a lot of money moving around for corporate organizations to support. And unlike in the U.S., whereby when you support, you make donations to a registered nonprofit, you get tax deductions. In Nigeria, it's not really that way. There is a tax bill, but a group of individuals sat down and made a list of organizations and government parastatals that they feel should receive monies from people, and people would get a tax deduction based on that, which is not, I mean, I've seen the list and it's not realistic in any way. A few months ago, I started talking to some of the legislators, some of the Congress people that bill needs to be revised. There should be an independent body whereby we need to emulate what the U.S. is doing and have an agency whereby we'll structure, have the criteria. As long as you meet this criteria, you can then get a tax deduction. You can get a number, for example, like the 501c3 or 501c4, whatever it is. And anyone who supports you or don't make donations at that point gets a tax deduction. We don't have that. They just have a list, and that's to the best interests of some individuals. So there are a lot of challenges there. So we're also talking to people to see how we can change some of the policies where that comes to getting financial support out of Nigeria anyway. And in the U.S., like I said, we're learning around, and we have to definitely talk after this interview and see how we can all support each other.
Absolutely.
And go ahead.
Sorry, I did have one question for you. I think part of the problem people face a lot of times, especially people who might be listening to this, are sort of that transition from working to starting their own company. And now you're a multinational company. You are in Atlanta and you're in Nigeria. So we heard a little bit about you are back working at McDonald's, but then we jump to 2016 and you have a large company. Sort of how did you start? How did you get into that at all?
Well, I did not have to work at McDonald's because I needed to work at McDonald's. That's the difference. Working at McDonald's was my choice, and it taught me a great deal of important factors in life of the discipline, hard work. As long as you work hard, as far as I'm concerned, hard work doesn't kill anybody. as long as you earn that dollar that gives you self-respect, you can hold your head up. Those were very amazing principles that I have learned that money cannot buy. So I already come from a wealthy family. Where I am today is not based on the wealth of my family, nevertheless. But apart from McDonald's, I've worked at Prudential Insurance. I worked there while I was in college. And I've been able to save. And along the line, I got some money from my parents. I put that a little bit in business. And then down the line, I decided to add more to it. And then voila, here we go. But today, I am who I am based on hard work. And I'm a believer. And then trusting in God that I had opportunities, which I was able to identify and use well to my advantage. So different people for, you know.
Absolutely. One thing I would say to that, and I don't know how long you were at McDonald's. I don't remember what you said, but I think experience in retail or working at a restaurant or working at something like that is invaluable. I think it actually should be a part of college educations, and I'm not kidding.
I agree.
I think Harvard graduates could use a couple years working at, I worked at a record store and I worked for a while and I liked it, but it also kind of, it not only does it kind of teach you what you said, discipline and hard work, but it teaches you a lot about how people work. It teaches you that you go a lot farther with people being polite rather than being demanding.
True.
Little things that maybe you're not taught in a class, but after you deal with enough customers that are yelling at you, or I had one swing at me once, And you know, you have to tell them at 10 a.m. we don't have any cash to buy your CDs, and they're not into it. And you, once you have to deal with that, yeah, it's really an issue. So I definitely heard that part. So that made me kind of rang a bell in my head. I would recommend everyone do it. It may not be glamorous, but it's completely valuable.
Absolutely,
I agree. Mudape, did you have a question for anyone?
Well, I think because I wasn't here when the other gentleman was talking, but I think once we get off the air, I will ask more details, how we can help, because we're new in the U.S. per se, even though we have been registered in the U.S. for ages, but we didn't attempt making any reaching out to different partners. So I think after the show, I would get more details and see how we can help.
I actually have something a little bit I could follow up with, because it was one of the things you asked. And when you were talking about working from out of two different countries, Augur works out of, as far as I know right now, I think we're out of three different countries. And we don't have a hub. I mean, technically, our two biggest hubs would be San Francisco or Atlanta, because actually Atlanta is, you know, I'm here and one of the co-founders was from Georgia. But in San Francisco is kind of a tech hub, and we had some of our developers there. But we have individuals in Texas, Illinois, Spain, where else? They're everywhere. They're all around the world. And that's a unique thing where when you have to deal with that, you know, that's why for me, I live on Pacific Coast time for the most part. So I'm getting up at noon, which is nice, but it's also like, that means I'm working until, you know, 8, it depends on the day, of course. And sometimes I'm taking calls with Australia at 1 a.m. or, you know, and those things can be interesting. So I would imagine the travel has got to be a killer, because I hate travel. I'm 6'4". I hate traveling, and I have to do a lot of it in the next few months. And because I will make kind of a mini announcement. We haven't made the official one yet. Augur's participating in the Exponential Finance Conference again in their innovation lab. We were asked back after last year because we were ridiculously successful, and it's one of the most influential fintech conferences of the year. And that's going to be, I think it's the 7th and 8th of June in New York City. With that being said, and I'll be there, but that's another trip I'm making. But back to my original point, I just had to plug our stuff because, you know, we've got an audience, right? But what I will say is that the travel has to be awful, and has your business, like, just been blessed by the internet, because you could like at least communicate easier?
To some extent, but that's one of the things that I would definitely love to discuss with you, because technology is everything. Wherever you are, you can reach out to the whole world, and you cannot, like you said, having the right audience. And if we do not have the right technology supporting us and expanding our services and people knowing what it is that we're doing, we cannot actually expect to get the right support that we need to get in the long run. It's like how they say you wink in the dark, and if no one sees it, it's just as useless as not winking. I guess something to do with marketing. But nevertheless, if we're not using up-to-date technology for the world to know what we're doing, we cannot expect to get not just financial, but also technical and manpower support. So it would be great to definitely talk to him and see what it is there, how we can work together on that, on promoting.
Why don't I just say some stuff here?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, platform, yes. Well, no, it's all of our, it's the, their platform, but they've given us time. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, we have,
use it.
Yeah, as long as it's
take
okay.
Take advantage.
I would say there's very easy tools like that. Now, also, I don't know how your coworkers or your employees, whatever, however they're termed, I don't know what their level of internet access is. I don't know. But what I do know is that little things like Google Hangouts are great. Google Hangouts for conferences are just a godsend.
Slack, for example.
Yes, Slack. Slack is amazing. And you see, I subscribe to 8 different Slacks, and it does get annoying, but you're right. Slack is...
This is interesting.
And free, because, and free.
But, you see, that's a bit... In America, you have fast internet connection. We don't. You're trying to load a page in like 5-10 minutes. You're like, well, this thing move. And we're charged per data.
So wait a minute. But SMS. Yes. So let's go back to SMS then, because SMS would be, because I have done a little bit, because there's some remittance companies I've assisted with and kind of given them some advice and just, you know, not, and I know that SMS, you know, text messaging is that's their primary method of communication. Now, is there a text option, or is there any way to make a simple way to work as a group through text messaging? That I don't know this because I haven't had the need to, but it sounds like there's a need. So it sounds like if there's any budding entrepreneurs out there, come up with this, or, you know, tell us what it is. But I would assume that would probably be the most ideal way, right?
They do have, yes, the option of bulk SMS. But of course, those are not free.
This is true.
So how do you communicate now?
Emails. Okay. And try and have people, can you send this information through your network and that network, which is very limiting because you really can't grow as your growth is quite, our growth is quite limited based on that.
Yeah. I think it's completely different in the US is what we're touching on. First, Slack, for example, is if you have a team of however many people, you can communicate at 2 or 3 in the morning as long as someone's there to chat. It's almost a formal or an informal email. But touching on the data usage and things like that, I don't know the best way. Maybe something with WhatsApp or SMS, like you're saying.
I would guess. And the funny thing with Slack that I would say, and another quick plug, Augur was voted named as one of the top 100 most influential Slacks or startups. Just for the record, and it's public. We have a public Slack. We have private rooms for the team, but anyone can go to our general room and you can find a link to that. But yeah, Slack, I mean, but Slack is also, if you're in the tech bubble, which I think we both are, we're like, oh, Slack. And then you kind of say, oh, not everyone knows what Slack is. And then I go, okay, yeah, I subscribe to so many Slacks. And one of the problems that I have is that I have so many that it's always beeping and I'm annoyed because mm-hmm. I'm just like, I don't care. and it's projects that I just assist with, but I like to occasionally ask a question. But yeah, in an environment where, and this is a global environment, there needs to be a way. And I bet there's some way to use Slack through SMS. And so if you're using email, I'm assuming they have internet connections that are just slow, right?
Yes.
Okay. I think there might be, Slack might still be an option because it's just a messaging service and you can even use IRC channels, which are even less bandwidth heavy than email. Now, mind you, that's a little technical, but it's very simple to use that. So I would say Slack may not be out of your radar.
Doesn't WhatsApp have SMS support?
They may. I'm not a WhatsApp user, but they very well may.
Well, that's why, like I said, we're planning on going local. So we intend having an office here in Atlanta. So we will be able to tap into these different options that's free because there's so many avenues out there to promote what we're doing, our causes, and create awareness and get the right support we need. But we have to start working from it more from here because this, you can reach more of the places than what we're doing in Nigeria at this point.
Okay. And guys, to close, I want to go around the room, and what advice would you give to a young entrepreneur just starting out? Is there a specific piece of advice that you would tell them? We can start with Sean.
Yeah, personally, I would say the best thing, piece of advice you could give to someone looking to start a business or get anywhere in the tech world or even get an internship, I think the best advice is to just simply start. So what a lot of people do is wait for the best opportunity or the exact right person and sort of wonder why someone else is progressing. And I think the point they need to take away is it's better to just start and work your way up through something or up to something even better than to wait. Stored, for example, we were a marketplace and we've pivoted to be an on-demand service now. But if we had waited 6 months to start and not fumbled with the marketplaces at first and seen how that worked out, we might not have ever gotten to this iteration. So I would say to any young budding entrepreneur, you just sort of have to start. And then the second piece of advice would be really just tap into your network and see what mentors in a space you're interested in. You can find any parents, friends, because ultimately any successful businessman more or less doesn't mind giving advice or almost taking some young entrepreneurial person under their wing and helping them get started.
Okay. Tony?
Yeah. What he said was great. The other things I would say is don't get into anything for the money, because that's usually what happens. Is if you're going into it and you're chasing the buck, there's usually, if that's your passion and it's not what you're doing, then it's going to be clouded and you're not going to have the dedication that you would otherwise. And that's hard for people to understand, because everyone, you know, is chasing the dollar, and it really is true. But if your motivation is, this is really cool, that's why I got into it. I really like Bitcoin as an idea, and I followed it, and now I'm here, right? I was working in a completely different space, two completely different spaces. And mind you, I wouldn't call myself an entrepreneur, but I would say I'm a part of the founding team, so I'm very close. But I would say that is one good one. You know, obviously don't be afraid to fail, but the same. And the other one is try to be honest. Honesty is very underrated, especially in marketing. There's a lot of, I don't want to use a bad term, but BS. And if you can cut through that and be completely honest with your customers, and it will end up being better for you. Like there's the great old marketing tale is the whole Tylenol scare, right? And how Tylenol dealt with that. And that's a great thing I wish all marketers would read, because now every time there's a crisis, look what's happening here in Atlanta with Comcast, how much money they're spending on trying to say why they're better than Google Fiber. Mm-hmm. Guess what? It's not working. You know why? Because people hate Comcast. If you put that money into improving your customer service, that's good marketing spending, not just firing doors. Like, they don't get that. They'll never get that. But you know what? If you're a startup and you have two or three people, you can get that. That customer service matters in every industry, regardless of if it's a nonprofit. You got to take care of the people that are interested in what you're doing. And if customer service is the best marketing you can have, because if they have a good experience, they'll tell other people.
I don't mean to jump back on really quick, but going off what Tony said, the honesty part, I think, is where you're going to get the most out of it, especially with mentors or anything like that. The most success you will have with them is saying, I don't know yet. Like, mm-hmm. I've never experienced this, and being honest with them, because then they'll actually be able to help you, as opposed to sort of not playing off your inexperience, which can be very beneficial to you.
Okay. Mutabe?
Definitely, you have to love what you're doing. If you don't even bother, and be able to make right sacrifices. Like Tony said, if you're in there for the money, that's going to be quite tricky, because I know every venture, every business I've owned or that I own, or even the charity, even the nonprofit, I put a lot of my personal funds into it. There are times some projects I finance 90% of it, if not 100%, and I don't mind, because I believe in it. And if you don't have that passion, that genuine passion, you will fail, because there will always, always be challenges, always. And when you get to a hurdle and you look at it and you're wondering, okay, what am I getting out of this? And you feel all of a sudden that this is not going to work. You will give up. So you have to be ready to make sacrifices, even if you're not getting the results you want initially, but you just keep going. That's the only way you can get through it, no matter what it is, be it nonprofit or profit making, whatever it is. The passion and, like you said, honesty, definitely their key.
Well, Mutabe, Sean, and Tony, thank you so much for being on the show today. And if your business is doing something exciting and you would like to be featured on Business Radio X, reach out to us on the contact page at businessradiox.com. All right, my friends, thank you for listening. I'm Alex Gossett-Shiflett, your hostess with the mostest. And as always, I'm wondering, who will be my next guest on Business Radio X?